Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the humanitarian crisis in the north of Iraq, where Iraqi Christians and Yazidis are fleeing the murderous Islamic State fighters, who, according to conflicting reports, have captured the important Mosul Dam. David Phillips, the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and author of Losing Iraq: Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco, joins us from Iraqi Kurdistan to discuss conflicting reports that the U.S. has bombed two towns IS has seized and assess why the Obama administration is clinging to the futile hope that an inclusive Iraqi government can be formed when the country has already all but disintegrated. Then we will speak with John Dean, who was legal counsel to President Nixon during the Watergate scandal and whose testimony helped lead to Nixon's resignation on August the 9th, 40 years ago. The author of a number of bestsellers, we will discuss John Dean's latest, just out, The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. We will trace the new evidence John Dean has uncovered of Nixon's cover-up of a crime that he had no knowledge of, the Watergate break-in, and try to understand the deep character flaws that drove this president, who had engineered great foreign policy achievements, to destroy his own presidency over a two-bit burglary. Then finally, we will get an assessment of the implications of President Obama's recent forceful defense of net neutrality that contradicts the direction that his own hand-picked head of the FCC appears to be heading in. Michael Copps, who was an FCC commissioner from 2001 to 2011 and is currently the head of the Media and Democracy Reform Initiative at Common Cause, joins us to discuss the enormous grassroots pressure building on the head of the FCC ahead of the upcoming vote on the future of the internet and whether it will be enough to counter the money and lobbying power of the giant cable and telecom monopolies. And joining us now from the Turkish-Kurdish border is David Phillips, who's the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University. He's the author of Losing Iraq: Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco, and he is a former senior analyst and foreign affairs expert to the U.S. State Department during the administration of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And his forthcoming book is The Kurdish Spring, A New Map for the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Phillips.
Thanks very much, Ian.
And the latest reports are suggesting that the U.S. has already conducted airstrikes against two towns in the north of Iraq and close to the Kurdish area, and that is the towns of Gweir and Mahmur. And what's peculiar about this is that Rear Admiral John Kirby, the Pentagon press secretary, has said on Twitter that the reports of the bombings were false. So you're there on the ground. Is there any local coverage? Because apparently Kurdish television has carried this story that there have U.S. has been bombing, and this has been carried on television in Erbil.
So the Turkish media doesn't have any report about it, and the websites are ambiguous, given the fact that Admiral Kirby has denied it. You know, I think that there's still some serious doubt as to what's happened. It's also rather curious that they've bombed these two towns. Mahmur is southwest of Erbil, but it's nowhere near Mount Sinjar, which is where the 40,000 Yazidi displaced persons are holed up on the mountainside. So if we're trying to create conditions for rescue to help the Yazidis, and we seem to have picked a bombing target that's not really relevant. A lot of questions still unanswered. I think we just need to keep our gunpowder dry and see what happens.
Well, clearly there is a humanitarian disaster underway with these Yazidis and exposed on top of this mountain without food or water. Children are dying. And then on top of that, you've got these droves of Christians being driven out. And everybody has good reason to leave. They're fleeing for their lives because they're just slaughtering people. IS is based upon slaughtering even fellow Muslims who they considered heretics. And, of course, Yazidis and Christians are even further beyond the pale in terms of these religious fanatics' worldview. So it does seem that even if these reports of bombing these two towns are true, it seems at this point too little too late.
And the targets that we've selected aren't going to save those people that are on the mountain. It's not going to rescue the Yazidis. If we are looking to engage the Islamic State fighters militarily and try to turn the tide of battle, then we want to hit them on the front lines. And Mahmoud is on the front line. I think the White House needs to get out in front and explain the situation, describe its goals, and make clear to the American people what's going on and what the extent of our involvement is.
And you're in the region where IS is supposedly making military gains, supposedly having taken three towns, and there are conflicting reports over whether or not they've taken this major dam, which supplies most of the electricity and water to Iraq, so it's obviously a key strategic target. There's doubts about the military situation, but I guess there can be no doubt that Christians and Yazidis, an ancient religion that preceded Islam, they have fled these towns in northern Iraq. Is that your understanding from being there on the ground?
There are three villages west of Mosul that are inhabited by Yazidis, and those were overrun over the past several days by Islamic State forces. Several hundred thousand Yazidis have fled. There's a group of up to 40,000 that weren't able to escape the Islamic State, and they've scaled a mountain, and they're perched on the hilltops without any life-saving supplies. So there is a twofold humanitarian disaster pending. The 40,000 Yazidis that are on the mountain, and then several hundred thousand that are on the move.
And is anybody getting to these? I mean, are they surrounded, the people on the mountaintop, by these IS fighters who they've executed people in these towns and in other towns they've taken over based upon their religion? I mean, they even execute Shiites, members of their own Islamic faith, let alone what they would consider heretics like Christians and Yazidis.
They went into Mosul, and they've gone into Sinjar, and they have basically told the Christian and Yazidi minorities there to convert to Islam, pay a special tax, or face death. So that's a pretty stark proposal. Many people have been killed. Men have been executed in front of their wives, and their wives have been taken as jihad brides by these Islamic State forces. So what's going on the ground is absolutely inhuman. The Islamic State armed forces are brutal. The fact that they were able to overrun the Iraqi army and seize all of this armor and equipment, which is made in the USA, which they're now using against the Kurds, it just shows how the situation has deteriorated.
And at this point, it does seem that the White House does not want to in any way cooperate with al-Maliki. They're actually trying to get rid of him. And you have this paralyzed government in Baghdad and with the country under siege from these extraordinary fanatics. Do you think that President Obama has the option of not launching airstrikes via Baghdad, but rather via Turkey, for example, where there's a big, huge NATO base?
So from the beginning, President Obama has said that there would be no U.S. military action until there was a new government, a new inclusive government in Baghdad. That was before this latest attack in Sinjar. I don't think that you can sit on the sideline and let thousands and thousands of people be killed or die from exposure. There are plenty of options if the U.S. wants to launch airstrikes. Operation Northern Watch was launched out of Incirlik Air Force Base in Diyarbakir, where I am right now. They could use that facility. They could move aircraft carriers nearby. There are logistically several options. But I think the major problem is this commitment that exists in Washington to finding a solution to Iraq's problems through an inclusive government. These are the same talking points that existed 9 and 10 years ago. Firstly, there is no prospect of an inclusive government because 40% of Iraq is now held by these Islamic State forces. And there's no prospect for Iraq reconstituting itself. Now, the government in Baghdad is a proxy of Iran. So we're still deluding ourselves into thinking there's a political solution. There is a security solution if we're prepared to launch airstrikes and arm the Kurds, who are very capable fighters but haven't seen a new weapon in 12 years.
So this is the hang-up then, that we're still following or trying to cling to this delusion that somehow you can force Maliki out and form an inclusive government and then somehow defeat the ISIS, who control 40% of the country, moving towards the main source of electricity and water and poised on the outskirts of Baghdad. And you've got this autonomous area in the north where you are, with the Kurdish region, which has proven itself to be stable, peaceful, industrious, and the Peshmerga have proven themselves to be good fighters. So it seems like a no-brainer to deal with reality. So what do you think is stopping Obama from just saying, to hell with Maliki, let's support the Kurds and at least stop these crazy jihadists?
Instead of working with our friends and our allies, who are the Kurds, we are trying to placate our enemies in Tehran and in the Islamic State. We need a wake-up call. Iraq isn't a failed state. There is no state. It doesn't control any territory. And even if they find a new prime minister to replace Nouri al-Maliki, it's going to be a selection made in Tehran. And we'll have no influence over that person. So the idea of an inclusive government and a political solution, you know, is just a daydream. There is a security solution if we're prepared to provide weapons to the Kurds so they can counter the armor that the Islamic State has. And in the future, the Kurds aren't looking for a handout. All they want to do is to be able to sell the oil that they have so they can use that revenue for state building and to provide security. But the U.S. is actively campaigning countries around the world to prevent them from buying oil from Iraqi Kurdistan. It's just a policy that makes no sense.
And meanwhile, IS, who've captured a bunch of oil fields in both Iraq and Syria, they're selling their oil on the black market. So
they've been selling oil from the Hasaka fields in Syria, you know, for over a year. They've seized new fields now in Iraqi Kurdistan. You know, when they marched into Mosul, they robbed the bank and walked away with $430 million. So these guys are loaded. They got lots of money. You know, they have lots of fighters. They have state-of-the-art weaponry. And meanwhile, the Iraqi Kurds have a battle-tested force, the Peshmerga, which means those who face death. But they just don't have the weaponry to counter the Islamic State. Meanwhile, they're losing territory. Apparently, the Islamic State are now 20 miles from Erbil, the capital. And if Erbil falls, you can kiss all of that Western cooperation on energy development goodbye.
Again, I'm speaking with David Phillips, who's the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and the author of Losing Iraq Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He is a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama, and his forthcoming book is The Kurdish Spring, A New Map for the Middle East. And he's talking to us from the Turkish-Kurdish border. What kind of advice is Obama getting on this? I mean, I understand, you know, he is at least responding to the 40,000 people without food and water on a mountaintop surrounded by a crazy bunch of sectarian murderers. But on the other hand, what you just told us, how close they are to taking the capital of the Kurdish Republic in the north of Iraq, it's just mind-boggling that, first of all, that people haven't seen this coming. And if this dam falls into the hands of the IS, my understanding is this big dam, the Mosul Dam, is itself an accident waiting to happen because it was so badly built. You have to continually pour grout in to stop the thing from literally exploding and sending a 65-foot tidal wave through Mosul all the way down to Baghdad. So if IS take it over, just through incompetence and negligence, the place is likely to explode.
So 2 points here, Ian. Kurdish intelligence knew that Islamic State forces were massing outside of Mosul. They reported that to officials in Washington and in Baghdad and warned them that the Islamic State was about to swarm across the border. So none of this should have been a surprise. When they took Mosul on June 10th and the Iraqi army was totally flat-footed, you know, they should have been prepared. Kurdish intelligence warned them. You know, now this Mosul dam has been taken. You know, it's 30 miles upriver from Mosul. So if the dam, which is poorly constructed, does fall apart, it's going to unleash a wall of water that would wipe out the city of Mosul, every community downriver in foreseeable sight, and all kinds of farmland. We should not allow this to happen. It's easy to roll back these gains through airstrikes. It's easy to save people's lives with a humanitarian drop of essential food and water supplies. What it takes is decisive action and a willing to commit U.S. Military forces. The president's made it clear there will be no boots on the ground. Well, let's get some wings in the air and start taking care of this problem.
But the part of it that I don't understand is that what apparently is holding up any response to this humanitarian catastrophe and the possibility of these IS people taking even more territory and perhaps even destroying much of Iraq is that there's this ridiculous political game going on trying to leverage al-Maliki, which you've made a pretty clear case is a complete waste of time. You also have this huge NATO base, right, at Incirlik in Turkey.
And it's a Turkish Air Force base.
Yeah, but it's been used by NATO forever. And couldn't they stage out of there, the U.S.? Would the Turks give them permission?
You know, the Turks have a stake in this, especially given their prominent position in Iraqi Kurdistan's oil and gas sector. So they have an interest in preventing the Islamic State from taking over. You know, with some effective diplomacy and some robust action, you know, you can bring Ankara on board. The point about Maliki, I think, has to be underscored. It doesn't matter who is the prime minister of Iraq. He will be acting as Iran's proxy, and he will not control a huge chunk of the country. So this fiction that there's a political solution to Iraq's problems is entirely uninformed. We should be working with our friends, who are the Kurds, instead of trying to make nice with our enemies, who are in Baghdad and are controlled from Tehran by the Quds Force. So, you know, this is a wake-up call. If we can't stand up and prevent the Islamic State from taking over, then everything we've invested in Iraq and all the promise that exists of having a policy that focuses on stabilizing and strengthening the Kurds just goes down the drain.
But this doesn't sound like, you know, we have the luxury of these deliberations going on. If IS is poised to take over the capital of the Kurdish region in the north, and all it would require would be U.S. help in terms of equipment, because the other side, the IS, have all this stolen top, you know, state-of-the-art American equipment that the Iraqi army abandoned when they fled. And here we are still trying to put Humpty Dumpty back together again in Baghdad and ignoring the reality on the ground that is moving so rapidly against, not just against American interests, but against Kurdish interests and against, I think, the interests of civilization. I mean, the idea that minority religious sects can be murdered in genocidal proportions, I can't believe anybody can countenance that.
So it's horrendous what's happening. The Islamic State is incredibly abusive. You know, we hear the White House spokesman talking about human rights violations, and let's call it what it is. They are beheading people by the scores. They're committing crimes of sexual violence. They're stealing women for jihad brides. They're allowing little children to die from exposure. They're threatening tens of thousands of displaced persons. If it's within our power to save lives, then we shouldn't be sitting around the Situation Room deliberating options. We should be decisive and make decisions.
And what's your sense there on the ground? What are Kurdish officials telling you, and what are Turkish officials telling you?
So it's a very chaotic situation. I'm hearing all kinds of conflicting reports. You know, I've heard that the Islamic State is on the run, and the Peshmerga hardcore are now mobilized and are going to make a move to liberate Mosul. You know, I read international media that talks about these forays around the perimeter and towns like Mahmur that have fallen recently to the Islamic State. So the situation really isn't clear. What is clear is that the U.S. and the Kurds have an important relationship that dates back to 1991. Turkey, our ally, and the Iraqi Kurds have a strategic partnership with lots of commercial and energy implications. Israel and the Kurds also have commercial contact, and Mr. Netanyahu has said that he would recognize Iraqi Kurdistan if it declared independence. So we should just be very steely-eyed and recognize who our friends and allies are in the region and work with them and have them work together to deal with this incredible menace.
So do you have any idea, just in closing, David Phillips, why Obama has and the Obama administration have been so flat-footed on that? We know they're preoccupied with wasting their time trying to come up with a unity government in a country that's falling apart and is ceasing to be a country, and the people that they're working with are essentially the Iranians. Are they trying to keep their talks with Iran going on? I mean, why don't they see the writing on the wall about who their friends in the neighborhood are and who their enemies are when it's so stark in this current situation?
Military reengagement in Iraq is President Obama's worst nightmare. Mm-hmm. He was elected president on a pledge to withdraw from Iraq. You know, he did that on schedule. We abandoned a status of forces agreement negotiations that would have kept a residual force behind for counterterrorism and to train the Iraqi army. He just wants nothing to do with the place. Now he's forced to reengage because the U.S. does have a considerable investment of troops and treasure that span several administrations. And we just can't walk away from a humanitarian emergency and pretend as though tens of thousands of people aren't at risk of dying.
Well, David Phillips, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with David Phillips, who's the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University, and he's the author of Losing Iraq: Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. He's a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the United States Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama, and his forthcoming book is The Kurdish Spring: A New Map for the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break and back talking with John Deans, whose testimony helped lead to President Nixon's resignation on August the 9th, 40 years ago. And joining us now is John Dean, who was legal counsel to President Nixon during the Watergate scandal, and his Senate testimony helped lead to President Nixon's resignation. In 2006, he testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee investigating George W. Bush's NSA warrantless wiretap program, and he is the New York Times bestselling author of Blind Ambition, Broken Government, Conservatives Without Conscience, Worse Than Watergate, and his latest book just out is The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It.
Which also has now made the list.
Oh, which list is that now?
The New York Times list.
Oh, excellent.
Five days out.
Well, congratulations. And, of course, August the 9th, it will be the 40th anniversary of President Nixon's resignation. And clearly, you were, in terms of your testimony, it was all of the president's men against you until our mutual friend Alexander Butterfield testified to reveal the tapes. And I guess you spent more time than any other human being on the face of the earth listening to these tapes. Would that be accurate?
Well, next to the staff of the National Archives, I'm right up there, I'm sure. And to my amazement, Ian, when I started on this book where I really, my editor said, are there any questions you really think should be addressed as we approach this 40th anniversary? And I said, yeah, there's one. I've never been able to figure out how anybody is really politically savvy as Richard Nixon let a bungled burglary just destroy his presidency. I said, you know, yes, I was there, but I didn't deal with the president until 8 months after the arrest. So I suspect the answer is on the tapes, and the answer is on the tapes. But I didn't know that I would have to personally put together a team as well as myself to transcribe them all and catalog them all and digitize them all. So that project could be done, and it took 4 years to do.
And you added 634 more tapes to the record.
Well, it's apparent to me that nobody outside the archives had even ever listened to those, and actually it's much more than that. I did 1,000 tapes because I found that the few transcripts that did exist, maybe 12 were really good from that had been used in the trial, that had been prepared by the prosecutor's office, then the various defendants like Haldeman and Ehrlichman, who were on the tapes, corrected them. Those were the best that were existing. The rest were, from the prosecutor's office, were merely FBI secretary first drafts, and they didn't even know who was talking half the time. Stanley Cutler does a good job on the ones he did. He's a historian who forced Nixon to release a lot of his tapes. But Stanley's collection is pretty much, when I talked to him, I said, how did you select them? He said, the ones that looked like they'd be interesting. And I was trying to track it literally from the first day that Nixon returns to the office after the arrest on June 20th until the plug is pulled on the system to see what's revealed with every Watergate conversation. So I had to redo all of Stanley's because his are partial, and ellipses that he might put in the middle of a transcript could be 50 minutes of conversation I might think was important. Plus, I was able to digitize all this stuff, and that made me able to hear things people who work with merely the analog originals couldn't.
And all of these tapes and all of this enormous effort that you put into your new book, The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It, I mean, it's really the genesis and an analysis of the cover-up itself.
Because that's when the White House becomes involved. That's what Nixon becomes involved in. It also, however, is not solely isolated because one gets a pretty good feel for Nixon's thinking about a lot of things. While they're not necessarily, I didn't seek those out. There are lots of other conversations that I didn't transcribe, but I'm following the Watergate thread through all this. Other things do slide in. And I didn't do it as a book of transcripts. It's narrative and dialogue. So I, in the narrative, often put in context what else might be happening.
But what's extraordinary about President Nixon is this total disconnect between the consummate foreign policy president and this foul-mouthed, deeply prejudiced, deeply flawed human being. It's extraordinary when you listen to the tape of, when he's talking about Daniel Ellsberg and railing against the Jews and a Jewish conspiracy and how they're all clever and deceitful and tricky and all of this stuff that almost goes back to the original Tsarist calamity about the protocols of the Elders of Zion. I mean, it's amazingly
You're right.
Reactionary stuff. And yet here's the president who literally saved Israel's bacon in the Yom Kippur War. So how do you...
He's a very complex figure. He's a fascinating figure. I was talking to some newsmen who are doing some material for the anniversary of the 40th anniversary of the resignation, and a couple of them said, we've studied lots of politicians, lots of presidents. nobody fascinates quite like Richard Nixon. He's unpredictable. He is strong in some ways, but weak in others. And that makes him, he's totally unpredictable on these tapes. And the way I had it, had them done, I had the transcribers working well in front of me so that I could do them in chronological order. Because I helped and transcribed about 250 conversations, but mine are very much at the end, where the story was better known and what have you. So it's the beginning that I flushed fully out in the middle that nobody had paid any attention to. And it was just, to me, there's not a page of this book that something new doesn't pop up that I sure didn't know, including my own conversations, Ian, where, because I was able to hear the audio for the first time on many of them. And you get a whole different sense when you hear somebody, the inflections, the reactions, and all those things fit in. And the way I told the story, that I can put that kind of explanation in dialogue.
In terms of listening to yourself advising the president, the most famous phrase from you in this private conversation with President Nixon, which of course was taped, was when you literally tried to save him from himself, where you say there's a cancer on the presidency.
Tried to warn him. Tried to warn him. I didn't know at the time how much he knew. I do know today, Ian, because of the listening to all the conversations that preceded, as well as those that follow, that he knew much more than he was letting on to me that he did know. He knew that hush money was being paid. He had personally been involved in raising hush money. He had sold an ambassadorship to get money for the Watergate defendants. He had suborned perjury of the key witnesses. He's deeply involved in the whole thing. But when I go in to warn him, I don't know that, and I'm trying to tell him that this is all obstruction of justice. And I get his attention by telling him there's a cancer on the presidency. As Stephen Colbert said the other night when I did his show, yeah, that'll get somebody's attention.
but it may have got his attention, but it didn't stop the trajectory, did it?
No, it didn't. I failed totally in my effort to try to convince him to stop it. Every time I raised a problem and a horrible, he had an answer. You know, I'd tell him, you know, people are committing perjury. Well, John, perjury's a tough rap to prove. You know, this will cost, who knows how much this will cost, Mr. President. Well, how much could it cost, John? Right out of thin air, I pull $1 million. That would today be what, maybe $5.5 million? Thinking that was a number that he would think just out of the range. And he said, well, that's no problem. I know where we can get $1 million. And I now know, and explain in the book, things like the fact that after I leave the office, he calls Rosemary Woods in and says, how much do we have in our slush fund, Rosemary? The one only that you and I know about. And they've got $400,000 in there. So lots of little facts and some big facts that we didn't know about Watergate emerged from the undertaking I took to listen to all the conversations.
But what's extraordinary, though, is that, and it really gives weight to this idea that the cover-up is worse than the crime, was that Nixon, according to the new research that you've done, John Dean, in your new book, The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It, is that Nixon did not know about the Watergate break-in to the Democratic National Committee offices. And that was organized by John Mitchell?
It was approved by John Mitchell,
right.
Yes. There's just not a scintilla of evidence that Nixon knew. So that his motive in the cover-up is he's protecting John Mitchell. Haldeman had told me on more than one occasion that Richard Nixon believed the only reason he was president was because of John Mitchell leaving his law practice and helping him get elected in '68. And he was just eternally grateful for that. So he felt very protective to Mitchell. He was convinced, as everybody else was, even before Mitchell admitted it, that Mitchell had approved these plans. It wasn't necessarily that he approved the break-in that day. What he did is he approves the plan in general. Liddy had already gone into the Democratic headquarters looking for information on Larry O'Brien, financial information. They hadn't even been able to find Larry O'Brien's office. So they went back in the second time to look for to go to the office, find the location of the office, put a bug in that worked. And actually, their mission that night was to go to McGovern's headquarters. they're just going to stop by and correct this little problem with the Deans at the Democratic National Committee. And had they been arrested, however, in McGovern's headquarters, as I point out, I found other recorded conversations that show that Nixon clearly gave an order to Haldeman to put a plant in McGovern's headquarters. I'm not talking about a flower. I'm talking about not that kind of plant, but that could be interpreted anything from an electronic device to a secretary or an intern or a chauffeur or something like that. And had what happened is Haldeman then has his aide, Gordon Strawn, called Gordon Liddy to the White House and read him instructions saying, change your intelligence gathering from Muskie, the front runner initially and the likely candidate would run against Nixon, to McGovern, who had emerged as the person he would probably be running against. So had they been arrested at McGovern's headquarters, you'd trace it right back to the Oval Office.
But even what was done really was hadn't been done before in American politics. It's always been pretty dirty. A lot of money's changed hands, etc. But this was a whole new level of mendacity.
I think Nixon always felt that anything had been done against him was fair game, and anything any of his predecessors had ever done was permissible. The difference I found is that while those things had happened in the past, with Nixon they become standard operating procedure, whereas in the past they'd been the exception to the rule.
Well, what I find, though, extraordinary, and I think you can make the case that, and others have tried to make the case that our current cynicism about politics and politicians began with Watergate. And I recall when the tapes were first aired to the public, there was a tremendous shock in the public that somebody in this hallowed Oval Office could swear like a trooper and have such a foul mouth. I think it shocked a lot of people. But I think the most shocking thing that I find about our current era, our current political environment compared to back in 1973 and 1974 is, for example, the Republican Howard Baker coined the phrase that you've kind of alluded to in your subtitle of your new book, John Dean. What did he know and when did he know it?
That's exactly what Baker asked me, if you will. I actually put the question in the front material. What did he know and when did he know it? He asked me as a very effective cross-examination technique.
Right, but the fact of the matter was he was a Republican and he was a reasonable man and he tried to do a conscientious job. You would not find anybody today, I don't think, in the Republican Party that would step up to the plate like Republicans did. Because after all, it was phone calls from Republican senators and congressmen that finally convinced Nixon to resign, wasn't it?
Well, not yes and no. He was getting a lot of pressure. He realized he had no base left in the House or Senate. He could count noses as well as anybody else. And then he knew that the impeachment process was going to run its course, and he was going to be voted to be impeached by the House and convicted by the Senate. So rather than have that happen, he took his full resignation and his pension with it and left. So, this story that I recounted, it's just not a rehash of Watergate when I got into all this fresh material. It was more dramatic than I thought. It's much more human, the story, because the other material that most historians have relied on was just material that that prosecutors had pulled out to make their case and show the criminal activity. You miss all the context. You miss all of the agony and the effort. Which, when you cover it day to day, it's a very human story. There are lots of life lessons to read in something like this. I'm delighted that I'm getting reaction from reviewers that it reads like a novel and is very telling. One reporter who I talked to a couple of days ago on the radio said, John, I hadn't planned on reading your book. I started reading it, and I couldn't put it down. And authors love to hear that.
Well, you've got a Shakespearean character there.
Yes, you really do. He has remained fascinating. He is unpredictable in where he goes, and that makes the story go in all different directions. He has good moments. He can be very manipulative, He's a master at assembling. He can somehow keep his story straight to different members of the staff when he's giving them misinformation as he's playing and manipulating his key aides, Haldeman and Ehrlichman and Golson. It's quite fascinating.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, John Dean.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with John Dean, who was legal counsel to President Nixon during the Watergate scandal, and his Senate testimony helped lead to President Nixon's resignation. In 2006, he testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee investigating George W. Bush's NSA warrantless wiretap program, and he is the New York Times bestselling author of Blind Ambition, Broken Government, Conservatives Without Conscience, Worse Than Watergate, and his latest book just out is The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the implications of Obama's forceful defense of net neutrality. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Copps, who was an FCC commissioner from 2001 to 2011, and he currently heads the Media and Democracy Reform Initiative at Common Cause. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Copps.
Glad to be back with you.
And President Obama on Wednesday before the U.S.-Africa Business Forum in Washington gave a ringing endorsement of net neutrality. People have thought that he was a bit wobbly on it, and his choice of the new head of the FCC would indicate somebody that was a lobbyist for the telecom giants would tilt us in that direction. And he has the plans that they have developed for net neutrality essentially what Obama is repudiating. Is that the way you read it? That he's actually repudiating his own head of the FCC's plans?
Well, I welcome the president's statement. It's a lot clearer and a lot more clear-headed than the FCC chairman's discriminatory fast-lane, slow-lane proposal. So I hope that the commission is in listening mode. There is a proposal pending at the FCC that seems to tilt towards a fast-lane, slow-lane approach, but also keeps open the possibility that we could reclassify broadband as a telecommunications it really is, and thus be able to guarantee network neutrality. That's a subject that gets somewhat in the weeds. We can talk about it if you like, but that's the essence of what needs to be done. I am pleased that the president has gone on record making clearer than ever that he's not in favor of a fast lane, a slow lane approach. And he joins 1 million Americans who have already contacted the FCC saying they're not in favor of a fast lane, slow lane approach either. And there seems to be an overwhelming preponderance of comment at the FCC in favor of classifying broadband as Title II telecommunications service, which would allow the FCC to move to guarantee an open internet.
So, Michael Copps, how do we navigate between the fact that the president on Wednesday said he was in favor of an open and fair internet and went on to say that you have big, wealthy media companies who might be willing to pay more, but then also charge more for more spectrum, more bandwidth on the internet so that they can stream movies faster, or what have you. And at the same time, his choice to head up the FCC has put forth this fast lane, slow lane system, which is a sort of the nose of the camel for a form of payola, where the big companies can basically pay to fast-track their content at the expense of everybody else's. So, again, I'm just puzzled about you're a former FCC commissioner. The president that appointed you, would you listen to him? I mean, what's the relationship?
It was a very different circumstance. I was actually appointed when President Bush was the president of the United States. I was appointed to a Democratic seat on the advice of Senate Democrats, and obviously I did not agree with what President Bush's chairman of the FCC did on network neutrality or the classification of broadband or the great consolidation that has taken place in our media industries. But the FCC is an institution that is beholden to the public interest. That's its charge. The term public interest is mentioned 110 or 112 times in the statute that authorizes the FCC. And I have seen public pressure make a difference before in decisions at the FCC, and that's what I'm relying on here. It's most helpful to have the president chime in. The FCC is an independent agency, as you know, so the president does not dictate to it, but I think it's more than simply interesting to commissioners there to know where the president stands on this. And I think if Mr. Wheeler and his colleagues now listen to the American people and look at the record and hopefully get out of Washington, D.C. and hold some hearings around the country where they can hear from people who have to live with the decisions that the commission makes, maybe they'll push back. I haven't given up on Tom Wheeler making the right decision here. I hope that he will. I understand, as you said, he has a corporate past, but I think also he hopefully is realizing that he has a new constituency now, and I think he's, just from the standpoint of practical politics, maybe beginning to realize that he lighted a fire that maybe is flaming out of his control, and maybe he'll see the need to backpedal.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Copps, who was an FCC commissioner from 2001 to 2011 and currently heads the Media and Democracy Reform Initiative at Common Cause. But the Tom Wheeler, he's more than aware, right, that a million Americans called up and to the FCC and apparently crashed their internet site.
That's right. That's right. This is a grassroots effort, and I don't think it's partisan. I don't think it's red state, blue state. I think people understand that this broadband internet is vital to their future. This is how they communicate with one another. This is how they get their news, and this is how they get their information, and it's vital to them. And I don't think they want to see a few special interests empowered with gatekeeper control and lots of money and lots of lawyers and lots of lobbyists who are going to be able to exercise control over what should be a communications network that serves the needs of the people. We can't afford to have fast lanes and slow lanes and the ability of any company to tell us or direct us to what news they want us to see or to be able to shut off what advocacy group or cause or interest group wants to say on its own. That's not commensurate with democracy. This is all about media democracy and democracy generally. It's, I think, perhaps the most important issue facing us right now. So what we need is real grassroots continuation of that grassroots movement. I think it's wonderful that over a million people have written in to the FCC to go on record, but we need more than that. The other side is entrenched. The other side has wheelbarrows full of money and legions of lawyers and lobbyists to do their bidding, and you know the power of big money in our society right now. And in our government right now, I think you'd have to go back to the first Gilded Age of the 1880s or the 1890s to find a time when special interests wielded more power than they do right now. So this is it's an uphill battle, and we need to wage it on all fronts. And people shouldn't think that just because the president has now opined, and that's important and that's hugely welcome, but even that may not be enough here. And in the final analysis, what's going to count the most is what the American people do between now and such time as the FCC votes.
And what is the time frame on that?
Well, that's kind of up to the chairman when he controls the agenda, when he thinks it's timely for him to vote. I think most people think that that's probably not going to happen now for 2 or 3 months because of the pushback that we've seen from the American people. But then again, this is high stakes policy making, and only he knows when he's going to call the vote. So we can't just say, oh well, this is something we'll get to in November or December. People need to be acting now.
But, Michael Copps, is it possible, though? I mean, do you think that Tom Wheeler, it seems like he's trying to thread the needle between what the big telecom monopolies and oligopolies want, which are these fast track and slow track. And it's a mutually exclusive system, the Internet. So if you fast track your content, you automatically slow down everybody else's. That's what they want. On the other hand, the public is voicing its opposition, and it seems like he's trying to steer a middle course. My understanding is that there really isn't a middle course here, that the best route would be to reclassify, as you mentioned a little while ago, the Internet, so that it can be regulated by the FCC, and that's where we got into trouble in the first place, because that's what Michael Powell, who was the chairman under George W. Bush, did. And ever since then, that's been the nose of the camel for the media oligopolies.
Well, you're exactly on target, and it was a horrendous decision starting in 2002 with the Powell Commission's decision to call cable modem an information service, taking it out from that part of the law that regulates telecommunications, and where telecommunications was regulated is where you find all the consumer protections and privacy and reasonable prices and all that sort of stuff. That's where it belonged. It was a ridiculous decision, and then that was extended to the rest of telecommunications, basically, in 2005. We need strong rules, the rules even that the court overturned earlier this year, passed by the previous commission under Chairman Jonakowski, were tried to go down that road you're talking about. Let's find a clever new way to do this so that industry isn't too terribly upset about it, and we'll pin it over here to this other part of the law. The only way to do this is to call it Title II telecommunications, and that's what the commission needs to understand, and the president needs to understand, and everybody really needs to understand. The court virtually told the commission, if you want to do all this net neutrality stuff, you can't do it under where the previous commission said you can do it, or where Tom Wheeler's proposal says you might be able to do it. If you want to do that, you should have called it a common carrier, called it a Title II, a telecommunications service in the first place. So you even have the courts who turned down the rules, but saying if you still can do rules, but do them right.
So that was
for God's sake, let's do it right this time.
And you're referring to the Verizon case before the
Second
Circuit Court of Appeals, which went in favor of Verizon, but the judges went so far as to sort of basically give the FCC the kind of wake-up call saying, wait a minute.
Right.
There's a
well,
way
that's
to
absolutely
get...
right. Now, to be candid, that's one court, although that was the court of jurisdiction here. And whatever the FCC decides will end up going through... court channels, but it's clear to me that this Title II is the one where the strongest legal defense for strong net neutrality rules resides, and that's the one we need to be taking. We can't afford to mess around with, oh, let's try another way, or, hey, look, I just found this other gee whiz approach that nobody thought of before in this section of the law, and then we have 2 or 3 more years of haggling over that and court decisions, and all that time the industry is consolidating more and more, fewer and fewer companies exercising monopoly control over broadband in so many areas of the country and developing their gatekeeping powers. We have no internet neutrality rules right now. The court threw everything out. It's legal for companies to block, to discriminate, to speed up, to slow down, and we got to put an end to that.
Well, but that's obviously the decision that that the Powell FCC made is also, I think, made a fortune for these companies, hasn't it?
Because Oh my goodness, yes.
You don't have any regulations. Everybody that's got a gets their cable bill knows that you have a poverty of choice. You don't have any choice in the first place about who your cable carrier is, by and large. And now you have people like Fox and Time Warner. Now, it looks as if that merger is not going to happen, but it came pretty close. So there's no doubting the power of these big companies. But is it right to say that these companies have gotten rich in part because of the fact that they have been deregulated, essentially?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, for the first 8 years I was at the commission, that's all the commission majority did was deregulate, drive a stake through the heart of competition. The 96 telecommunications law, 1996 law, actually envisioned competition, not just big companies, but little companies and wholesale access and open access and things like that. And all that was done away with. And meanwhile, you had all these mergers. And, well, you correctly point out that this one merger, apparently the parties are not going to put that together, but there are lots of other mergers going on. We still have the Comcast Time Warner Cable before the commission, another AT&T merger. And, you know, it never ends, these mergers. They just keep coming, and they make the companies more powerful. And to me, the business plan of a lot of these companies is not to really build out fiber to every nook and cranny of the United States, but to ration the scarcity that they have. It makes them a lot of money, but it doesn't get broadband out, high-speed, high-value broadband to all of our citizens. And that's why we are so low in the rankings of nations when it comes to the penetration of broadband, the speed of broadband, and the value of broadband that our consumers get.
And just to buttress what you just said, these big companies also preemptively sue states and municipalities to prevent them from having broadband as a utility like they
do. Isn't that amazing? There are now 20 states that have made it extremely difficult and in many cases impossible for a municipality to build out its own broadband, even when a Comcast or a Verizon or an AT&T doesn't want to build there right now. They don't want anybody else building there either, so they've gotten these states to pass laws making that impossible. That's not the way you get infrastructure out to rural America and Native Americans and the inner city and to all Americans, because we all need this. To me, this access to the broadband is, in the 21st century, pretty much a civil right. You can't be a fully productive citizen in this country without access to this new communications network that's at the center of our lives in so many ways.
Well, Michael Copps, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Happy to do so. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Michael Copps, who is an FCC commissioner from 2001 to 2011, and he currently heads the Media and Democracy Reform Initiative at Common Cause. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graeme Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.